Welcome to episode 6 of Working Title Podcast. I'm Joshua Paul Kane, and today I will be speaking with author Lamar Giles. I had read and I recommend his debut novel, Fake ID. Since then, he has written two more mystery novels. We discuss them, what you may not know about the Witness Protection Program, nurturing a child's love of reading, and mastering the query process. Enjoy! Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So first question, have you ever had a fake ID?
I didn't. And here's the truth. I tried. When I was in high school, there was a guy at my school who made the best fake IDs I ever saw.
Oh, right.
And he was charging like premium prices for it. So the truth was, I was working my little part-time job at McDonald's. I was saving up for one. And he got busted maybe like a month before I would have had enough money to get one. So it was sort of, I guess it was serendipitous in a way. It was a good thing that it happened. I didn't need to have one. I didn't need to be out there doing things that a fake ID allowed you to do. And pretty much everyone who bought from him got busted, too. So, no, I never had one. I was fortunate enough to miss that opportunity.
Okay, good. So it was that experience what gave you the idea of the book? Because it's an interesting premise. I don't think I've ever read a book or even heard of a book where a teen – is in the Witness Protection Program.
Well, no, actually, I didn't get the idea for fake ID until well beyond that time in my life. I was probably in my mid-20s. I read a lot of things. I was reading a nonfiction book called Inside Witness Protection. It was by a guy named Gerald Scher, and he's the guy who thought up Witness Protection.
Oh,
like,
really?
It was his idea. Yeah.
Wow.
And so he's telling all these stories about all the problems they had with the program initially back in the day. And one problem they had that they never considered was when they take these criminals and pull them out of their environment and put them in, say, like a town in Idaho, that their personalities don't really change. So they'll take this, like, hardened criminal, put them in somewhere in Idaho, and go check on them, like, a month later, and they started up, like, a racketeering thing, or they're extorting people for money. And, and so then it's drawing attention, it's messing up the community, so then they have to move them again, give them a new identity, and so basically start over. And it just occurred to me that what if you were the child of someone like that? And the idea for fake ID sort of snowballed from there.
Wow. Yeah, I hadn't considered that either. It's like a leopard can't change its spots.
Right. It's a lot of cool stories in that book that gave a lot of great inspiration for fake ID. And it's interesting because, you know, you really can't research modern witness protection. Like, there's a reason why they're secrets. And this book allowed me to kind of lean on things that have been declassified, so to speak.
Oh, wow. How did you go about researching it? Do you have contacts? Did you know people who knew people?
Well, the beauty of it is, because there's really no detailed modern info, mm-hmm. and I had that book, I had a lot of, license to create things.
Sure.
What I did was kind of create more of a hyper real world. The comparison that comes to mind, like, right away, is just because I saw this movie this past weekend, is the world that John Wick exists in. Have you seen that film?
I've not seen it, but I know of it. That's with Keanu Reeves, right? And he's
yes.
a hitman or something? Or?
Yeah, and so this isn't necessarily a spoiler. In the initial movie, they set up that there's this whole sort of assassin community. Oh. I mean, like, they're very civil. They have traditions and a currency. And it's sort of this weird thing where these hardened killers sort of have a place where they hang out and just not talk business. And it's the sort of reality that fake ID takes place in. It's this – when I don't want to spoil too much about the
sure.
book. But, you know, you read it. And so you see there's more to that world than just – this one family being in this town.
Yeah, that was surprising. Yeah, that was a great element.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know that anything like that ever could really happen, but I think I made it plausible enough based on the detail that Gerald Scher's book provided.
Oh, great. Well, it lends itself to a series. I'm not sure if that was your intention, because I haven't read your subsequent books. Do they pick up where that one left off, or are they entirely different worlds?
This is an eternal sore point for me because the other two books are standalones. So Endangered is already out.
Right.
Overturn will be out at the end of March. When I wrote Fake ID, the intent was a series. I wanted to do at least 3 books, and I still do. Mm-hmm. But what happened is when I signed my initial publishing deal, and this is a potentially long story, so I'll keep it short. Nobody in publishing was interested. Give me a moment. Sorry, Siri heard me talking. I must have said something. But no one in publishing wanted that book. There was one editor at one publishing house that took a chance on it. And the thing was, when she did it, she's like, told me flat out, I can't give you more than one book contract at a time.
Okay.
We just don't know what it's going to do. There's not a lot of excitement. And I wrote Fake ID, sold that to her, and she's like, you got to give me something different for the next book. We can come back to this one later. But as I was writing Endangered, the second book, that editor left that house. So I'm what they call orphaned, right? I'm at my publishing house, and my parent advocate is gone. And I get reassigned to another editor. She's great. We have a great working relationship. But it's just that the Fake ID continuation is not a priority at that point. Even though I'm ready, I got most of a sequel written already. I hope to get back to it someday.
Okay, fair enough. Well, it certainly leaves open that door the way you ended it. So.
Yeah.
But it's
yeah.
Certainly a standalone. You don't need to read more to be satisfied.
But, Josh, people are mad. I get emails all the time. They're like, hey, where's the next book?
Oh, why really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I probably get, I would say at least, it's tapered off, but still at least once a month I get an email from someone that's like, hey, I love the book, but why did it end like that? Where's the rest? That, am I just, why can't I find the sequel? And that's frustrating. I really want to get back to that world.
Oh, my. Well, save those emails, right? To send
yeah.
a new editor.
Yeah.
Now, again, I've not read the other two. Are they also teen fiction, like the Fake ID?
Yeah. Both are mysteries like Fake ID. Mm-hmm. Endangered is about a girl who I call a photo vigilante.
Okay.
She takes pictures of the mean kids in her school doing dirt and publishes them anonymously online, exposing them.
Oh, wow.
Basically, she calls out bullies. And she ends up inspiring an unstable person to start going after these bad kids. So she sort of has to undo her good work to save them and figure out who this person is. So that's the second book. Overturn, which will be out March 28th, that's about a teenage poker player in Las Vegas who has to try to use her underground connections to figure out who framed her father for murder.
Oh, wow. Very exciting stories.
Yeah. I mean, if you like Fake ID, you'll like those. And Overturn, in particular, has been getting some really great reviews, so I'm excited for people to get their hands on it.
Oh, great. Well, much success to you.
Thank you.
What drew you to writing to this audience, teens?
Well, it's interesting because I started out my career, let's see, I'm trying not to date myself too much here, but I was probably 21 when I decided that I wanted to be a professional writer. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, I grew up reading and loving horror stories. So in my mind, I wanted to be Stephen King. And, you know, I had some modest success there, got some stories placed in some notable horror anthologies, but just wasn't seeing much interest in my work there. And at the same time, when I'm kind of struggling in that field, young adult books are starting to gain a higher profile, particularly because of the success of Harry Potter and the Twilight series.
Oh, that's cool.
And so I'm curious at that point, and I love the Harry Potter books. I didn't really get into Twilight too much, but I was really curious about everything else. And what I ended up discovering is so many fantastic books that were doing things creatively that I wasn't seeing in adult fiction. And, when I discovered Neil Schusterman's Unwind series, it blew my mind. And it opened up sort of these doors in my head of, like, things I could really do here. I'm like, I have some sensibilities with the skills I developed writing horror that maybe could transfer. And I started sort of just playing around with it. And in a way, I was still trying to write adult fiction, and I read that nonfiction book I told you about. I started an adult mystery about a grown-up woman who was in witness protection. And I probably wrote 30 pages, and it just wasn't working. It was real flat, didn't feel right. And because I was reading on a young adult, I said, hey, what if I try this from a teenage perspective and made it a boy. Mm-hmm. And I sort of got that idea about what if it was a kid or someone in witness protection, how would that be? And again, snowballed from there. I knocked out a draft in maybe 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, that, long story short, I got to, into writing for that audience because I was really excited about what I was reading for that audience and saw good opportunities there.
Well, it makes sense. Now, could you give an example? You mentioned things that just blew your mind when you were reading other authors. Mm-hmm. Do you have an example in mind that's something that really just opened up your imagination on what you could do in your writing?
Well, definitely Neil Schusterman's Unwind. Mm-hmm. That was probably the first book where I was like, wow. Because Neil, and I had the opportunity to meet him this past fall, great guy. And the way he built that world and made it plausible for do you know the series at all?
No, I haven't even heard of it. I've heard of Twilight and Harry Potter books, but not this
one. It's amazing. I highly recommend it. And essentially, it's about a future where after a sort of vaguely referenced civil war, mm-hmm. there's been an agreement that no abortions are allowed for fetuses. Mm-hmm. And so children get raised to the age of 13. Once they're 13, you have the option to retroactively abort, and they call it unwinding. And what happens is, if you have a troubled child, and troubled is in quotes because they use that broadly in that series.
Sure.
You can have them taken to a center and processed where they are pretty much dismembered, all the way to the most basic parts, and those parts are used to help injured people or some people with medical problems. And the thinking is, they're not being killed. They're being unwound, and their parts are doing good, where when they were whole, they weren't doing good.
Oh, my goodness. It's almost like Repo Men or something like
that. Yeah. I mean, it's done fantastically. I think there's 4 or 5 books in that series. All of them are genius.
Oh, wow. I'll definitely have to look for that. Yeah,
so that was the first. In terms of mystery, and that's the genre I pretty much work in now, there was a book by Peter Abrahams, I think is his name. I feel bad because I'm forgetting the author's name, but it was called Reality Check. And it was just like this really cool mystery about this boy whose girlfriend moves across the country and goes missing. And he pretty much hops in his car and goes to this preppy boarding school to figure out what happened. And I was just like, this is a really cool book. I love to do something like this. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, from that point on, I started reading a lot of my contemporaries. And I've since met many, many young adult authors who work in that field. So a lot of good work out there.
Well, that's great. Thanks for that info. I noticed in Fake ID in your acknowledgments, you thank both God and your mother for such helping your dream come true.
Mm-hmm.
And so what to you is success that you felt you have achieved? What was success for you in writing? You know, everyone has their own measure.
Mm-hmm. I guess first and foremost, a paycheck. I'm a Stephen King disciple, and so I really take it to heart in his book on writing when he talks about how being paid for your work is a form of validation. Mm-hmm. It's not the only form, but writing has done things for me at times when nothing else was working. I was a corporate guy for many years. I worked from the time I graduated college. I was 22 years old. I worked in a cubicle farm, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You go in every day. You're in your cubicle. You're crunching numbers. I did that sort of thing. And it wasn't really fulfilling work, but I knew I had to do it in order to support myself. I was married, I had responsibilities, but it was a sort of thing where if I didn't have writing, I could feel my soul being crushed, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And to be able to take the writing to a level where people pay for it, people buy it, it's in bookstores, that's success. And I'm not saying that like I'm not like one of the wealthy writers. I don't make that kind of money at all, but the idea that there are people all over the country who've read my work and been pleased is a great success when I spent decades just in my office, in my room, hammering this stuff out for myself initially.
I certainly understand. That sounds like success to me. and with your mother, what had she done? Did she, like, tell you, push books into your hands? Or, like, how did she influence you or keep you on the literary path?
Oh, well, for one, my mom used to do this thing. It took me a while to figure it out. I was a little kid. So, you know, like when you're a little kid and you go in a store with your mom, and if there's a toy section or something, you always want the toy, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so my mom almost never said yes to the toy. Toys were for, like, birthdays, Christmas. Mm-hmm. But I started to pick up one. If I asked for a book, she never said no.
Oh.
And it's not that my mom read a ton. We didn't have a the majority of the books in our house growing up would have been books I brought in. But it was a point where, like, no matter how many books I asked for, she was like, yes, yes, yes. And her thinking was it there was something to the fact that I liked to read so much at a young age, and she wanted to do what she could to nurture that versus what she considered to be sillier pursuits like watching TV all day. So just that alone developed a love of reading that would lead to the love of writing. So I thank her for that all the time. And then when she saw that I was starting to make up to stories and try to create them myself, she never said much. But one thing she did, she bought me a computer when I was 14. And this was at a time when not many people had computers.
Mm-hmm.
This was at the dawn of the Internet. And she made sure I had machinery that I could use to save all these writings. And she was never one to discourage me when I talked about I want to try to be a professional writer. She was like, just make sure you have ways to take care of yourself in case it doesn't work out, which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But she was never a person to doubt it. And so just that alone, to have someone in your home who encourages you to pursue something that doesn't necessarily have a guarantee of income or notoriety is a blessing in itself.
Well, go mom.
Yeah.
Do you recall books that you most enjoyed in your youth when you were?
Yeah. I remember the series, and I, for a long time, I wondered if I had made it up in my head because I could never like track it down. Then, of course, you know, the internet, so you could Google this stuff. It's a series of books called the Sweet Pickles books.
I remember that.
Yeah.
It was like the animals, right? Each animal had a book.
Yeah, and it was like one for every letter, I think. I don't know if that's right. I feel like that was the case. So, like, I feel like there would have been, like, 26 books and 26 animals or something like that. But I remembered enjoying those books a great deal. Dr. Seuss, Horton Hears a Who, is still one of my favorite books. I have a copy on my bookshelf somewhere right now, and I'm looking forward to reading it to my nephew. But at an early age, I sort of switched over to adult books. I remember starting to read Stephen King books when I was, like, 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And the most significant of those books would have been It, which I read when I was 11. And that's pretty much the book that changed everything for me. But, man, I could keep you here all day listing books I enjoyed. The Celery Stalks at Midnight, all the Choose Your Own Adventure books.
I love that.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I could go on.
I believe it.
Yeah.
Now, with horror, you said Stephen King a lot. I mean, is horror something you plan to come back to? Because you mentioned, writing short stories that were...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. In fact, there's an anthology coming out at the end of this year from HarperCollins called Three Sides of a Heart. And they're all stories about love triangles. And the story I wrote for that anthology is a horror story. I definitely plan to get back to horror. I just got to do some other things first. I mean... like I said, Overturn's coming out. I owe my primary publisher, HarperCollins, a different sort of book.
Sure.
But I certainly plan to get back to.
Is there a type of horror that you like? Do you like more like a gory kind or more that where the monster's always just off camera?
Yeah, I don't like the gory stuff as much. I like more of the – I really enjoy more Lovecraftian stuff. And I'm hesitant to say that because I don't know if you followed any of this over the years, but Lovecraft's a horrible person. He was a horrible person. He's a horrible, like, open racist, xenophobe.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Big dust-up in the horror community about even the use of his visage for, like, some of the notable fantasy awards.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But that being said, his concepts and what other writers have done with the like the Cthulhu mythos,
mm-hmm.
like those are some of my favorite stories. And so it's sort of that I like cosmic horror, I guess you would say, the stuff
right.
that sort of off screen inspires madness, the things we weren't meant to know. That's sort of the horror that does it for me.
Oh, okay. Now to switch gears, something I've always been fascinated about. When you spoke earlier at the writing show last year with James River Writers, the querying process, and I wondered how you can describe how that went. Like, you have this novel you want to get published, mm-hmm. and your idea is to go the traditional route, which is find an agent who will find an editor who will get it published, correct?
That's correct.
And so how did you formulate your query, and how smoothly did the process go? I mean, if mm-hmm. you can walk us through that, that'd be great.
Okay, so I'll give you a little bit of a preamble first.
Okay.
So keep in mind, I'm, from the age of 21, I'm trying to get the agent and sell the novel. Because mm-hmm. I started writing my first novel when I was 14. So I think, like, at every stage of your writing career, you think you're ready. But the truth is, probably in those early stages, you aren't. So the biggest problem I had with my query process prior to when it finally started to work is that I probably was not producing sellable material, number one. But I didn't know that. Like, in your mind, when you write it, you're a genius. You know what I'm saying? If someone needs to recognize that you are that genius. But the truth was, for a long time, it was just that the work wasn't that good. I'd done okay with the short stories, but the novel is a different beast, and I probably wasn't spending enough time working on craft and having the proper reading partners to give me honest critiques that make the work better. And the truth is, sometimes you got to knock out a few novels before you get to the one that's going to break through for you. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So
yes.
I put that out there just to set expectations. So from 21 to, I guess, the age of 30, I'm writing novels, trying to go through the query process as I saw it in things like Writer's Market, et cetera, and I'm getting 100% rejection. Yeah. I'm talking for 8-9 years. Every query letter comes back as a rejection.
Oh, man.
And I guess at some point I felt like I was on a clock. So I'm getting close to turning 30. I'm like, I really can't spend much more time not getting this right. Either it's going to work out, or maybe I need to move on to something else. That's kind of where I was. And so I was working on a fake ID. It was called something else. It was called Whisper Town back then. You read the book, so you understand the reference.
Yes.
And I felt like, okay, like every other book, I felt like I was doing good work. But something in me said, like, okay, this is something I think could sell. So if I'm writing this great book, I need to make sure when I present it, it's going to be presented in the best possible light. And that's something I've been doing wrong in previous years. I'd write a novel, think I was good to go, and sort of write a sloppy query letter, like just assuming that my genius would emanate from the letter no matter what. Two drafts, I'm done. And I was like, I can't do that this time. I put too much work into this book. I got the critique partners who gave me the good feedback. Now I'm going to make sure that when I send this letter out, there's no way to poke a hole in it. And so what I did, it was December of 2009. December, pretty much, I know enough about publishing at that point that I know December, everything's shutting down. Nobody's really caring about emails. So there's no point for me to rush sending anything that month. So I'm going to take the whole month and work on nothing but this letter. So that's a whole month to work on three paragraphs. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so I start the month, I write a draft, let it sit, go back, next day I rewrite. Let it sit, next day I rewrite. Keep doing that. Get to the middle of the month, I let a couple friends read it, they give me some feedback, I change it up. Throughout the course of that month, I think I did 14 drafts of that letter.
Wow.
But by the end of the month, I'm like, okay, this is good. This is the best query letter I've ever written. And the things I focused on were making it sound like the description of books that you read when you pick up a book in the bookstore. I'm trying to make it so that whoever gets this letter is enticed to see what's next. January 3rd of 2010, I think that was a Monday or whatever. I know everybody's coming back to work. And by that point, I've also researched very specific agents that I'm going to send to, because that's a mistake I made in the past too. I was sort of willy-nilly with it. I wasn't really narrowing down, like, who had recently made good deals, who liked the stuff I liked to write, who was at big agencies. And I separated these agents into categories, like, you know, three columns. Column A is my dream agents. These are the people I really want to work with no matter what. Column B is, well, I don't know much about them. I couldn't find much information, but they might be cool. Column C is, I'm not sure, but I wouldn't mind seeing if they're interested. Mm-hmm. So there's maybe 10 people across those categories. On January 3rd, 2010, I send them all the query letter that I worked on. Maybe 2 days later, I get the first email. And I'm so used to seeing rejections that when I open the email and read it, I actually read it as a rejection. Like, I mean, I really thought it was a rejection. I'm like, I had to reread it twice. I'm like, oh, they want to see the manuscript. By the end of the week, three people had responded. They wanted to see the manuscript, too. By the end of January, 7 of the 10 had asked to see my full book.
Oh, excellent.
So from 100% rejection to 70% success rate, that month was a month well spent.
It certainly was.
Now, here's the thing, though. Here's the thing. By the end of March, all seven of those agents had rejected the book.
Oh, no.
So, but at this point, I'm analytical. You know, I'm like, I'm used to rejection. My skin is thick. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking at it like the letter solid. Know that. I don't even have to change anything there unless I just want to tweak a word here or there. So it's the manuscript. And I'm trying to figure out what's going on. One agent gave me significant feedback. What she told me in her letter meant I had to change a major plot point. And again, I'm experienced enough where I know, okay, for me to change that, it's going to change the last 100 pages of the book. It'll take me 2 months to rewrite the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there like, well, that's worth it. I think that's a game changer. And so I do that, revise the book based on that feedback. And so I still have a list of agents. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to 5 this time. Mm-hmm. Now, I know the letter is solid. So if all 5 of them reject the manuscript, I still got work to do. When I queried those 5 agents, 3 of them offered to represent me. I had an agent by July.
Oh, wow.
That
sounds great.
I mean, to distill that into, like, short advice, you got to research. You got to make sure you're going to the right agents. It's no point in sending out 50 query letters to 50 wrong agents. You're better off with 10 query letters to agents that you've pinpointed.
Now, what's your research resources, like Writer's Digest?
Mm-hmm. I use everything. I use Writer's Market. If people don't know what that is, it's like almost like a telephone directory. For people who don't know what a telephone directory is, because we don't really use them anymore. It's a book that lists a lot of agents and editors in the industry. It tells you what they're looking for, and you pretty much can comb through it and pick out the people who seem like they might fit. So I use a combination of that. I use a combination of the writing magazines that will come out and tell you, like, hey, 20 agents to watch, 15 new agents looking for clients right now, those sorts of things. And then I would cross-reference that against all these agents' websites, their blogs. So, like, I would say, like, a good portion of every day, not a good portion, maybe like a half hour to an hour of every day, I'm researching agents and taking notes and just kind of stockpiling that information. It may not be anything you use right away, but it doesn't hurt to start learning it as soon as possible.
Did you have in your mind when you were going through this process that maybe you said, like, if I don't get an agent by the 50th query, I'll do something different? Or did you always, I'm just going to keep going until someone says yes?
Half and half. I knew I would keep going no matter what because I was writing enough material where I always feel like certain material is suited for different things. So I always felt like I was writing material that I would try to aim at traditional publishing. Mm-hmm. I was always writing short stories that I might try to sell. But I also started to learn about self-publishing and digital publishing. Mm-hmm. So I always knew that no matter what, I was going to at least dip into that realm. And if I never got a traditional deal, I just knew I would make my own books and sell them myself. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think I was on a time frame in the sense of, like I said, I was approaching 30. I didn't want to keep spending time getting rejected. I wanted to try to put my work out into the world and see what happens. So I knew I was going to go one way or the other, or maybe even both.
Okay. Now, what's your writing routine? I seem to recall that you get up early in the morning to write. Is that correct?
Well, I did when I was working my day job.
Oh, okay.
So I would have to be in the office like around 8:30, 9, I think. So I would get up around 5 in the morning.
Yeah, that's right, 5 o'clock, which I didn't know there was a 5 o'clock in the morning. So.
Yeah, yeah, I would get up at 5. And it would take like a half hour to sort of get my bearings. So it'd be, that's like, that 5 o'clock is like getting up, making coffee, sort of like, you know, shaking off the frustration of not being able to sleep longer. And I would write from like 5:30 to 7. And I would do that every day. Shower, go to the office, do my 8, 9, 10 hours. And be pretty worn out by the end of the day. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, incredibly tired. It probably wasn't healthy in the sense I wasn't getting much exercise. It was just writing and work. But I would rather be exhausted at the end of the day doing their work than trying to put 100% of my energy in the office and then only have, like, 40% for the write. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's sort of the routine I had for many years. I don't have a day job now, so I'm a little bit more leisurely with it. I still get up early because I've been conditioned to do that over the years, but now it's like I get up, cook breakfast for my wife, watch the news with her before she goes off to work, and then I'll start my day.
Oh, okay. Do you have a room, or do you go out, or what do you do for your writing environment?
Mostly I'm in my home office. Like, we have a room. It's just a bedroom that we use as an office instead of a bedroom. And so she has a desk on one side. I have a desk on one side, and I work from there mostly. I've been experimenting with some different routines because, honestly, I've been getting tired of being cooped up in the house every day. So now I use an iPad and a Bluetooth keyboard, and occasionally I'll go out and switch it up. I might go to the library. I might go to the local bookstore. I may go to the Panera Bread, something like that. Mm-hmm. But that's usually like a Friday field trip sort of thing. Most days I'm in my office.
Okay. Now, are you able to, like, sit down and focus, or do you have to fight distractions? And
For the most part, I can focus. I mean, I'm not going to lie. When I'm out in the public areas, I'm not as focused. I mean, you know, obviously you see certain things going on around you. It's sort of like when you wave the shiny objects in front of a cat. But for the most part, I can tune in. And the truth is, because they're Friday field trips, unless I have some sort of pressing deadline, I'm okay with not being as productive on those days. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Now, once you have a draft ready, do you have critique partners, or do you have a beta reader like that you go to?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have partners. Well, I need to clarify this. I had partners. So early, I mean, with Fake ID and Endangered, all I was doing was writing and going to my day job. So it was easy for me to trade off with my partners and to provide that same service for them. Mm-hmm. The last 3 years, I've actually been in grad school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And because I've been in grad school, school assignments make it so it's very hard for me to read for friends. So what ends up happening now is it'll be my agent and my editor.
Oh, okay.
And they're great. I mean, they give awesome feedback, but just because I haven't been able to offer the same sort of attention to my friends that I was used to doing, I don't feel comfortable asking them to do it for me. But now that that part of my life is over, I'm actually getting back into having the critique partners, reading their stuff and having them read mine. So, yes, I do, but I had to take a break from them for a little while.
Now, what about writing specifically that you most enjoyed? Is it like coming up with the story? Is it the dialogue? Like, what really fires you up when you're writing?
Well, the new idea is always exciting. Mm-hmm. So when there's a spark, and you know, over the years you train your mind to sort of think in what ifs, and so when you have that really good what if, and you start to see like possibilities for it, mm-hmm. that's super exciting, and that initial rush is a draw. Admittedly, when you get to the middle of the project, things start to drag a bit. And, you know, and it's like, you know, because the thing is, you're in the middle of something, and then you're still getting ideas, right? Mm-hmm. So you're excited about the next idea, but you're only a third of the way through the last idea. And so I guess I'm addicted to the high of a new concept, mm-hmm. and it's just I've conditioned myself. I've done the training to see the idea through to the end, even when I'm sort of ready to go to the next thing.
Okay. And when it comes to promoting your book, how do you get the word out? What do you do?
Mm-hmm.
Is it social media, your website? Do you just you know, well, press the flesh kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a little bit of all of it, and admittedly, I don't feel like I'm super great at it. And so I'm always trying to get better and trying to figure out how to better utilize all the various tools that are available. So, like, you know, I'm starting to use Facebook's advertising a little bit more to try to get the word out to people I don't know, because it's to the point now where if I know you and you've read the previous books, it's sort of easy to let you know something's coming out. Mm-hmm. But the challenge is to grow audience. And so now I'm trying to figure out how to get beyond the friends, family, and the trusted readers who are always curious about what's next. And so I'm trying to observe what other writers are doing. I haven't cracked the code on it yet. There are a couple of people that are really good at it. Daniel Jose Older, who writes fantasy novels. Like, he seems to be like a master of Twitter.
Oh, really? Okay.
There's a writer from Virginia named Ronnie Sidney. He wrote a book called Nelson Beats the Odds. And he's always great at promoting his work through social media. Like, I see him every day. And I'm trying to, like, observe these guys and see, like, how they do it. And I think part of that, the reason that I haven't been great at it is part of me is introverted.
Yes.
You know, it still feels difficult to talk about myself.
Yes.
So that's something I'm working on getting over, because the truth is you kind of have to.
Right. That's the reason we write it, so we'll have to talk to people.
Yeah, exactly. So anyone who's listening, feel free to email me tips. I'm always willing to learn.
Well, plug away. How do people contact you?
Okay, website, Facebook, Twitter. Twitter is – I love Twitter. So I'm at LR Giles on Twitter. My Facebook page is LR Giles Writer. I'm really starting to enjoy Instagram a lot. I have to actually look at my Instagram and tell you what my Instagram name is. That's how bad I am at this. Like, I can't even readily name all my various social media. Instagram is, it's just my name, Lamar Giles. I didn't know that. So, I mean,
very easy.
Yeah, very easy. But like I said, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, I really enjoy interacting with people through all of those. Hit me up.
Wonderful. Well, let's finish with this. Now, because you touched on this earlier about feedback, what has been the feedback to your books? And do you go to school since it's teen fiction, or do you go to libraries? Do you speak?
No. Yeah. I do all that. The feedback I see has been largely positive. I don't go on Goodreads very often. I made that mistake very early in my career, and that could be a humbling experience. And not to say that you shouldn't expose yourself to negative feedback. Like, it's always good to get constructive stuff, but sometimes the stuff on Goodreads is just mean. And the truth is, sometimes I'm sensitive about it, so it's like I have to kind of set aside times where I'm going to go out onto the internet and see the stuff people are saying that I may not like.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, the feedback I see has been positive, to the point where I get asked to speak at schools and conferences. I'm actually going to St. Louis in a couple of weeks to speak at two schools and a library. So, like, people seem to really connect with Nick and Fake ID and Panda and Endangered. And I've had the opportunity to see many students and librarians and really hear that the books meant something to them. And that's always been a very gratifying thing that I'm grateful for.
How do you frame your talk? Is it about the book itself? Is it about getting into writing?
Well, it changes based on what they ask for, because I've been in situations where people have wanted me to do more of a motivational thing. Because the thing is, what I found is a lot of my readers are reluctant readers. Okay. Like, they've not found books that they enjoy. I mean, particularly, I mean, we can have a conversation about diversity and representation in literature. But there aren't a lot of black boys mm-hmm. represented in young adult fiction, at least not as heroes, the way they are in Fake ID. So I've done many talks where I've dealt with readers who Fake ID may be one of the first books they ever enjoy, and they don't know what they want to do with their life, and they've never seen people like them do things other than be around their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been in situations where I've been asked to talk to them about how they can pretty much do anything they want. So in that case, I'm like a motivational speaker.
Oh, okay.
I've been in positions where it's been a group of young writers, and so they want to talk about craft. So in that case, I'm a teacher. And then I've been in situations where people are just sort of fans of the books and they want to know the backstory. So in that case, I'm just telling them a lot of the things I've told you. So it switches up depending on the situation.
But each time you find it rewarding, the reaction of the students?
Oh, yeah, I do. And this is the thing. Again, I mentioned that I'm introverted. So, like, this is the sort of thing, the public speaking is something that used to terrify me. And, I mean, in some ways, it still does. Like, there's still that old reaction of, oh, goodness, everybody's going to be looking at me. But there's not been a situation where I've gotten out there, and it hasn't been the best thing of that week.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, getting to meet these kids face-to-face. In some cases, I've had the opportunity to have real heart-to-heart talks with them and help them get through their day. So, like whatever little anxiety I feel about having to do it, is always eclipsed by the joy of actually doing it.
Oh, very nice, very nice. Well, I can't ask for more than that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining me on this podcast.
Oh, no, well, thank you for having me. I mean, it's been a good time. I'd be happy to come back again if you ever wanted to do this.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, great. You're the first one who said that. No, I'm
sorry. No,
well,
no,
I appreciate it.
Yeah, same here.
Well, best of luck in your upcoming novel, and we'll touch base again.
All right, thank you. You have a good one.
You too. Bye.